From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Changes at the U.S. Post Office ahead of the election are under scrutiny in a Senate hearing today, and Joe Biden is now officially the Democratic Party's presidential nominee.
In his acceptance speech last night, Biden framed the election as a choice between light and darkness, and he described what kind of president he would be.
But while I'll be a Democratic candidate, I will be an American president. I'll work hard for those who didn't support me, as hard for them as I did for those who did vote for me. That's the job of a president, to represent all of us, not just our base or our party. This is not a partisan moment. This must be an American moment.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC, and Juana Summers, political reporter at NPR. Welcome to both of you. And without mentioning President Trump's name, Biden said character is on the ballot, compassion is on the ballot, decency, science, democracy. Juana, did Biden do what he needed to do last night?
I think Joe Biden did exactly what he intended to do. You heard him in the clip that you just played talk about how he is the Democratic nominee, but he will be an American president. He showed that he was empathetic. He extended an olive branch to Republicans who may not typically look to a Democrat to support and said that there's space for you here. And most of all, Democrats had 4 days of programming that largely went off without a hitch. They were able to present a seamless picture of who their nominee is and the picture they want to present to the nation. So in that respect, I think that the convention overall and Biden's speech itself were successful.
Beth, there were some real standout moments. There was the teenager who described how Biden helped him overcome his stutter. Also a 95-year-old Republican, Edward Good, who parachuted into Germany in World War II, who said he will not vote for Trump again. Listen.
I think Trump has been the worst president we've ever had, so I'll be glad to see him go. I think Joe Biden will be a great leader for the United States. Like me, on the day of my jump into Germany, I think Joe Biden cares about doing his proper duty for the United States.
We also heard from other Republicans at this convention, which left a lot of progressives unhappy. Beth, what about that, about the sort of the lineup that we saw all week?
Well, to Juana's point, the lineup and the entire 4-day convention was really an expression of unity, talking about how Democrats are standing together as one behind Joe Biden and that Joe Biden will be the president of all Americans and not just half the country, which obviously is an implicit rebuke to President Trump, who often governs as though he's the president of red America rather than blue America and does so fairly openly. So the convention was extremely effective in that regard. Now, whether progressive happy and presented himself as someone who's a friend to Republicans and to those who he may not agree with or who may not agree with him. That's the decision that the campaign made very, very strategically, that the way that Joe Biden wins this is to convince a lot of voters who might be a little bit skeptical of him or skeptical of the Democratic Party that it's time to sort of put behind the rancor and the chaos of the Trump administration and come together to solve this coronavirus crisis and the economic collapse that have come along with that.
Juana, I want to ask you about moving forward during the rest of the election campaign. Are you surprised that Joe Biden has no plans right now to campaign in battleground states? New polls in Minnesota and Pennsylvania show Biden and Trump are neck and neck.
You know, I'm not surprised. I know that we've seen the president come out and have a number of smaller events, not huge rallies like we saw during the 2016 campaign. But I think by, in some respects, not going out physically to a number of these locations, former Vice President Joe Biden and his team are making an implicit statement about the stakes at hand because of the coronavirus pandemic, which, as he talked about in his speech last night, has already claimed the lives of more than 170,000 Americans. You saw them come out, him and his running mate Kamala Harris come out wearing masks. So I think by not physically going to these places, they're making an important statement about safety, one that I think a lot of voters, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, this is an issue that's top of mind for many people who are concerned about that right now and concerned about staying safe.
Beth, you also touched on this a little bit, but there's polling that shows Biden has not tapped in as aggressively as he could over the last few months with young voters, which, of course, are a major voting bloc and tend towards supporting more progressive candidates like Bernie Sanders. Do you think this convention did anything to shift this?
Well, they're certainly a major voice in politics. I would have to disagree that at this point they're a major group of voters. They have consistently underperformed as voters. I mean, if young voters were really the catalyst that we expect them to be, Bernie Sanders would probably be the nominee of this party. They famously stayed home and did not come out in the large numbers that Bernie Sanders was expecting to support his candidacy.
A potential voting block, yes.
Yeah, perhaps they will come out in the fall. It's certainly an expectation that the Biden campaign has, that he will motivate people, even those who aren't all that excited about his candidacy, that they must come out to vote against Trump. He's also underperforming with a couple of other constituencies that I know the Democrats are a little concerned about, particularly Latino voters. There's a lot of states now in play that have a number of Latino voters, like Arizona. So he's going to need to up his game there. But right now, the polling so far looks pretty strong for Biden. And President Trump's going to have that on his mind at his convention next week.
A big day today on Capitol Hill. There was a Senate hearing this morning, and Trump donor and the new head of the post office, Louis DeJoy, was asked by ranking Democrat Gary Peters of Michigan whether he talked with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin about delivery changes that have slowed down the mail ahead of the election. Listen.
I just said I'm working on a plan to improve service and gain cost efficiencies. But no grave detail other than that was about it.
Prior to implementing the changes, did you discuss these changes or their impact on the election with any Trump campaign officials?
No, sir.
Okay, so DeJoy said that there would be no changes to policies in the handling of election mail. He said that the Postal Service can handle election mail. Juana, did this allay the fears of voters or members of Congress about slowing down the mail ahead of an election?
You know, I think that remains to be seen, but you can look no further than the four nights of programming that we just witnessed from Democrats to show just how urgent of an issue this is for them. I think back specifically to the comments we heard on the first night from former First Lady Michelle Obama, who straight to camera talked to voters and told them, you know, pack a lunch, put on your comfortable shoes, go out there, wear that mask. You might need to stand in line for a while to be able to vote. And every single night of the convention, we heard Democrats urging their voters to show up, to request those ballots early, to be prepared to show up in person if need be. So it's clear that there is a sense of urgency and alarm around the party that the U.S. Postal Service may not have the resources it needs to actually process all of these ballots in a way that makes people feel like they have confidence in this election and that everybody has equitable access to the vote.
It was a tough week for President Trump, Beth. His former advisor, Steve Bannon, was arrested for fraud involving fundraising for a private section of the border wall. The Senate Intelligence Committee found that Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was in almost daily contact with a Russian agent sharing information with him in 2016. A federal judge ruled that Trump has to release his tax records. What do you think is the impact of all of these things? Or are voters tuning all of this out at this point?
You know, it seems that every week that goes by, we say President Trump had a rough week. And I would agree with you, Jeremy, this week was particularly rough. But, you know, he's got this incredible resilience, which is what I think his supporters really like about him. He just doesn't pack down. He doesn't stumble. He just keeps barreling forward. He's going into this convention next week where he will receive incredible adulation from the Republicans involved and the Republican delegates. He is going to make the case that he is the only one to out there to pull this country out of the pandemic and out of the economic collapse that we're seeing. He has no intention of ever saying that things should have been done a little bit differently. He projects this incredible confidence and this incredible determination, and that's, of course, what his supporters love about him. The question is whether or not they are enough to carry him across the finish line in November and reelect him.
Yeah, Juana, as you look towards the Republican National Convention, what will you be looking at? What kind of vision will the Republicans lay out from your view? What are some of the standouts?
Sure. So I think a lot of the pieces of the Republican convention are still coming together. So we don't quite know yet what this will exactly look like. But I expect you will hear President Trump showcase and his allies showcase the achievements they feel the president has had in his first term, and in a way that we somewhat saw with the Democrats, putting center stage everyday people who are affected by policy victories within a Republican administration. I think we're going to see something that looks completely different from what we saw from Democrats. And I'm looking forward to see what this format actually looks like in the middle of a pandemic where a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people socially distancing and things like that. And it looks like we might actually see some in-person gatherings among Republicans next week.
That will definitely be interesting to see what in-person gatherings will look like in the midst of this pandemic. With a little bit of time that I have with you guys, Beth, I mean, you laid out some of the things that you think Trump will be center stage, but what are some voices that you think we might hear from as well as we learn more about what's going to happen next week?
Yeah, well, we're going to hear from some lawmakers, of course, and we are going to hear from those regular people who will talk about how they've been affected by Trump's policies. But we're also going to see the culture war at hand. We're going to see the McCluskeys, that couple who pointed their guns at a Black Lives Matter protest in St. Louis. So Trump's not backing down from that.
Beth Fooey is senior politics editor at NBC and Juana Summers, political reporter at NPR. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks. California's Governor Gavin Newsom canceled his primetime slot at last night's Democratic National Convention, instead sending in a cell phone video that he took near an evacuation center as fires raged throughout his state.
Well, I confess this is not where I expected to be speaking here tonight. I'm about a mile or so away from one of over 370 wildfires that we're battling here in the state of California. We are just coming off a record week, a heat wave that led to 130 degree temperatures, highest temperature ever recorded in California, arguably the world's history here in our state.
At least five people have died in California as the wildfires force tens of thousands of people to evacuate their homes. Firefighters are battling three separate clusters of fires that are burning through rural areas in the San Francisco Bay Area and Central California. And authorities say many of those fires started with lightning strikes combined with scorching heat and dry brush. For the latest, let's bring in Daniel Berlant, Assistant Deputy Director for CAL FIRE. He joins us from CAL FIRE headquarters in Sacramento. Daniel, welcome to Here and Now.
Good morning.
You're now receiving your daily updates. What's the status of the fires right now?
Well, overnight, our firefighters made good progress on a number of fronts. However, the hot temperatures, the dry conditions, even overnight, continue to allow a number of these fires to grow. Several of the lightning complexes now growing over several hundred thousand acres. So a lot of land continues to burn. We are making progress, but it is an uphill battle.
It's so rare for there to be thunderstorms and lightning, and we understand that these fires are burning in three separate clusters. What does that even look like?
Well, these kind of thunderstorm systems are not completely something we see every single year. In fact, in just about a 3-day span, we saw nearly 11,000 lightning strikes. And what was different about this thunderstorm system is that while it brought lightning, it brought very little rain. That combined with the fact that we're in the middle of summer, temperatures were in the triple digits. In fact, we saw extreme record-breaking heat across California during this time period. So even though it was a thunderstorm system, there was no rain, it was hot temperatures. So it's the perfect conditions for fires to break out. So while most of these lightning strikes aren't able to grow into major fires, based on weather conditions, many of them are.
And I should say that you're at headquarters in Sacramento, so we're hearing lots of activity behind you as you all prepare to continue another day of fighting these fires. We're reading that there have been five deaths, three people in Napa Valley and one person in Solano County. And there are PG&E workers who've been helping as first responders. Are these fires burning in high-density living areas? And are you concerned about the further loss of life?
These fires continue to burn in populated areas. We have 62,000 people evacuated, 100,000 more under evacuation warnings. So there's a significant threat to life. And as you mentioned, five people have died. as a result of these fires. And it's just a reminder of how dangerous these fires can be. And, you know, a reason why we continue to put safety as a priority to ensure that not only our firefighters, but the residents we protect are safe.
We know that there's also been triple-digit heat in the area. Is that hindering the firefighters' ability to put out these fires?
The temperature, the low humidity, the dry conditions, these are not conditions that work in our favor. And they are the perfect recipe for wildfires to grow at a very large and fast rate. And so those are one of the challenges that we continue to face. Now, while temperatures are down from what they were over the weekend, while we're not seeing more lightning, it's still hot, it's still dry, and these fires are still burning.
There's also the issue of air quality. Is there any wind in the forecast or any relief for people in communities affected by all of this smoke and soot?
While we do have some wind on a number of these fires, the size of the fires, as they have gotten larger, now create their own weather patterns. And so the fire's weather fans itself, and it burns erratic. It burns in multiple directions. However, much of Northern California, we have an inversion layer that's holding much of this smoke. And so air quality is incredibly bad across much of Northern California and has spread to a number of the western states as well.
As you go into another day of fighting these fires, what do you want the public to know?
Well, it's really important that our residents continue to be on high alert, not just those that live around these fires, but we are in the peak of fire season. And so if a new wildfire breaks out, we need people to do their part to evacuate and evacuate early. That has been our message all along. We need people to leave the area when these fires strike so that we can get our equipment, our firefighters in there, and take a stand to stop the fires from burning.
That's CAL FIRE's Assistant Deputy Director Daniel Berlant with the latest on the dozens of California wildfires that are burning right now. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely.
This week, the U.S. drug maker Novavax said it's ready to start a phase 2 trial of its experimental COVID-19 vaccine in South Africa. Last month, the Trump administration awarded Novavax a $1.6 billion contract as part of its Operation Warp Speed program, with a goal of delivering 300 million doses of a vaccine against the coronavirus by January. Dr. Gregory Glenn is president of research and development at Novavax and head of the company's vaccines program, and he joins us now. Dr. Glenn, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, doctor, tell us briefly how your vaccine is supposed to work and why you think it's a better candidate than really the dozens of others in development around the world right now.
Well, the viruses infect humans by a little protein on the surface called the spike protein. You may know this. These spikes infect human cells. They're like the spacecraft docking to a space station. So if you can block that event, you ought to be able to block infection. And so we make a spike protein. We do it in a way that it's very similar to what you'd see in nature, which is important because the immune response is going to reflect that in a very precise manner. And so that's our vaccine. And so, you know, what we saw when we recently unblinded our first clinical trial is we make very high antibodies that can neutralize a virus or kill the virus. And so, you know, I think if you look at the panorama of vaccine technologies and the data shown to date, our data is really very, very strong. And, you know, has made everyone optimistic that this vaccine could work.
Well, Novavax, though, has never brought a product to market before in its 30-year history. You mentioned what makes you confident that this will be different this time. Assuming trials stay on track, when is the earliest you anticipate a vaccine going to production?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I wouldn't let this, you know, track record. I mean, this company is, in my view, has been around for 10 years, and they've done other things, but the shell of it, you know, was, you know, we took on a new technology, and frankly, it's a company now that we've been able to recruit people from big pharma, very experienced vaccinologists, thanks to COVID. So we're really actually, I think, going to become a vaccine player, an important, you know, producer of vaccines, thanks to the money that's allowed us to invest in the infrastructure that's needed. It's a very complex process to get to, you know, licensure of a vaccine. So I will tell you first, it's important to know this, that we should be committed to developing high-level evidence the vaccine is safe and efficacious. And so we're on that track. That track can be a little unpredictable because the actual testing of the vaccine in humans requires you to accumulate enough evidence that it really works. So if I came to you and said, hey, I've got this coin, when you flip it, it comes up heads every time. It's amazing. You would say, well, how many times did you flip it? And they say, well, twice. Mm-hmm. Well, you would not be convinced by that. You know, that would be just by chance alone. So we have to have the same sort of approach here where in a randomized, blinded, placebo-controlled trial where people don't know what they're getting until you push a button and unblind to show that there's evidence the vaccine is really working and it's really safe. If I had to say the optimistic case, we would see by the end of the year in one or more of the trials, we might have an efficacy signal read. And that will be that will then trigger, you know, an assessment of that by the FDA. And then that could lead to licensure. So, you know, we're all working as hard as we can to get to that earliest moment, but it's not going to be, you know, as soon as we'd like, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. You've said you're cautiously optimistic that we could actually see this vaccine in production by January. Are there any concerns at this stage for you and for the company as you move forward in thinking about getting this to people as soon as possible?
It's about execution. You know, these are really complicated trials. The manufacturing infrastructure requires a lot of people firing on the same page at the same time. I can tell you that's happening. I've never seen anything like this. Of course, none of us have lived through a time like this, but the broad motivation of our staff, they're working truly tirelessly, you know, 7 days a week. And we surrounded ourselves with extremely experienced, capable people. So all that, and you know, the technology that we're working on is the basis of a licensed flu vaccine already. So I'm pretty, you know, things are lining up pretty nicely that we could execute on that plan. But that is that's a big mountain to climb. And I think I have optimism with a real basis for thinking it could happen.
That's Dr. Gregory Glenn. He's leading the vaccines program for Novavax. Dr. Glenn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your interest. We'll try to get you a vaccine soon.
The coronavirus pandemic has caused countries around the world to spend trillions of dollars to prop up their economies. New numbers out of the United Kingdom today show that debt there has reached record highs and has soared past GDP for the first time in more than 50 years. That's a threshold the United States passed back in June. And that means the country has more debt than all the economic output in a full year. That imbalance is something economists have warned about for a long time. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, between January and today, this is the most debt growth the U.S. has seen since World War II. How much of that is because of the CARES Act?
Well, a lot of it, Jeremy. I mean, at $2 trillion, that is a lot of debt that's being added. But remember that government was running a deficit even before the pandemic hit. So that meant the debt pile was still constantly growing. And when you talk about the size of the debt in comparison to the total size of the economy or GDP, remember that the economy has shrunk pretty fast this year. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the definition of a recession. So it was a combination of those two things that actually caused the debt to be bigger than GDP.
And why is it such a big deal, something that economists have warned about for so long, for the debt to surpass GDP as it has?
Well, the thinking is then that you were just so in debt that it's going to be a headwind to growth going forward to service that debt, to pay down the interest on it. And that 100% is sort of, you know, a line in the sand that economists look at as sort of the danger zone, anything above that.
But we're not seeing higher interest rates or soaring inflation, which I guess would be signs that we've entered the danger zone.
Right. And, you know, there's a few different forces at work for that. Inflation would really be runaway inflation would really be the main risk. Currently, though, people are just buying a lot less of many categories of products. You know, think about business clothing or airline tickets. So that's kept prices in check in a lot of areas of the economy, even deflation in some areas. But that doomsday scenario also would likely occur in the currency markets. You know, if you think about it, if the U.S. was the only one in this predicament, then the dollar would really weaken significantly mm-hmm. against other currencies. But the whole world's kind of in the same boat here. So there's been offsetting factors in the currency market that has not caused, there has been some dollar weakness, but not really runaway dollar weakness that would worsen that inflation.
There's also the argument that many have made that not spending more money to prop up the economy during an economic crisis like we're in right now would be even more dangerous than ballooning debt.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's what's known as sort of your classic Keynesian economic thinking. And I think at least in this current state of affairs, it's pretty much indisputable among all economists. You know, I shudder to think about what the state of the economy and really not just the economy, but society as a whole, what it would be like if that safety net had not been expanded during this pandemic.
Well, and there are big questions about whether it will be expanded further in the months ahead, even leading up to the election.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And a hot topic. I mean, no one is really in the mood to be a deficit hawk, so to speak, to argue that we have to worry mm-hmm. about the deficit right now. But it's certainly down the road, it's probably going to become a topic again.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
The man who killed 51 people in New Zealand last year will be sentenced next week. Brenton Tarrant live streamed his attacks on Muslims during Friday prayers at two mosques in Christchurch. The massacre sent shockwaves around the world and led to stricter gun laws in New Zealand. Joining us now is Conan Young, a reporter with Radio New Zealand. He's in Christchurch. Conan, the sentencing hearings begin on Monday. What are they going to look like?
Well, yes, Monday we are going to see the sentencing of Brenton Tarrant on 51 charges of murder, 40 of attempted murder, and one charge of committing a terrorist act. And as part of that sentencing, it's going to last 4 days. First, we'll have something called the Statement of Facts, and this is where the Crown Prosecutor will read out the Crown's case against Brenton Tarrant. That will be followed up with victim impact statements, and there are 66 people who are going to stand up in court and face Brenton Tarrant, many of them people who were injured in the mosque attacks. This will be the first time they've seen him face to face. And they will, many of them looking at him straight in the eye, tell him the impact that his actions have had on them. There'll also be the bereaved, a number of widows, women who were made widows by these attacks, whose husbands were killed. And they will also tell him the impact that his actions have had on them. And then we'll have Tarrant himself will actually address the judge. Now, he's representing himself, and he's going to be making submissions on his own behalf. And then that'll be followed by the judge passing sentence.
So this is going to be a very emotional day. Is this the kind of thing that people all across New Zealand will be watching live as it happens on television?
There will be a lot of attention focused on the 4 days. There will be no chance for live reporting or viewing of what's happening in court live. The judge has decided at 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. each day, he will provide instructions to media in court about what can and cannot be reported from the sentencing. And obviously the intention there is, especially with Tarrant making submissions on his own behalf, the judge will be very alive to, you know, any sort of inflammatory statements or anything that Tarrant might want to give as part of the sentencing. So the judge is going to make sure that that doesn't see the light of day.
I want to play a clip from New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. Here she is speaking at the memorial service after the massacre last year.
Our challenge now is to make the very best of us a daily reality, because we are not immune to the viruses of hate, of fear, of other. We never have been. But we can be the nation that discovers the cure.
Now, she says the viruses of hate, this is before the coronavirus was part of all of our lives. Now, in New Zealand, the authorities were able to halt the spread of the virus completely before it returned again recently. What is the coronavirus situation where you are now?
That's right. Yes, we went incredibly just over 100 days with no cases of COVID-19. We now have had a resurgence in our largest city in Auckland. And so that city is subject to some pretty severe restrictions on people's movement, people not being able to go into work, etc. The rest of the country is subject to less harsh restrictions. And then I'm in the South Island, and we haven't had any cases. There will be issues for the sentencing itself. There's not quite as many people allowed in the courtroom at any one time. Probably the biggest impact at this stage of the latest outbreak is a delay to the election. Opposition parties were complaining that you know, the lockdown, people them not being able to get around and meet and greet people as part of any sort of election campaign was going to was unfair. And so the Prime Minister recently just announced that we're going to delay our election. It was going to be September 19th next month. It's now been delayed by 4 weeks to October the 17th. So yeah, we're all just hoping that we can stamp out this latest outbreak and get back to being one of the lucky few that has no cases of COVID-19.
That is Conan Young, a reporter with Radio New Zealand, joining us from Christchurch, New Zealand, ahead of the sentencing for the man who killed 51 people at two mosques in Christchurch in 2019. Conan, thank you.
No problem.
Well, here in this country, coronavirus infections are still high, but continue to slowly trend downward. Over the past week, the U.S. has reported an average of about 46,000 cases, new cases every day, about 1,000 new deaths. States like Iowa, Kansas, and North Dakota have seen some of the sharpest per capita case increases in the past 2 weeks, while Texas and Georgia are still struggling to contain widespread outbreaks. 6 months of rising infection rates have put tremendous strain on hospitals across the country, but now there is a glimmer of hope. It's a new portable isolation unit that promises to cut the cost of personal protective equipment. John Kalish reports.
The Care Cube is a 10-foot by 10-foot by 7-foot plastic and steel structure.
It amounts to a large, very clean tent that has air filtration.
That's Saul Griffith, who runs an engineering firm in San Francisco called Other Lab. In addition to the HEPA filter used to create negative pressure inside the unit, the Care Cube has a hug suit, a plastic compartment built into a wall with sections to insert one's head and arms. It also has glove windows, which allow medical personnel to reach in and manipulate a patient with their arms. Doctors and nurses can treat patients without wearing PPE.
We've heard from our various partners that a single COVID patient in a hospital causes the use of up to 200 sets of PPE, gloves, masks, visors, gowns, and there's an extraordinary amount of time and risk of infection in the constant replacing of PPE and what they call the donning and the doffing.
The Care Cube steel frame and vinyl walls can be shipped in a 2 foot by 2 foot by 4 foot box. It's received an emergency use authorization from the FDA and is expected to sell for $5,000 per unit. Development began last November with funds from the CDC. When the coronavirus pandemic began, the first prototypes were completed ahead of schedule. The Care Cube's frame is made of 1-3/8 steel poles. Its vinyl walls are connected by zippers, so you don't have to be a construction whiz to set one up, says Brenton Piercy, the lead designer of the Care Cube.
It's like watching anyone put up a tent for the first time. When we send it to our medical professionals, they average around 30 to 45 minutes to set one up for the first time ever. Once you have done it once or twice, yeah, down to 10, 15 minutes, pretty easy to hit.
Because doctors and nurses won't need to wear PPE while caring for a patient in a Care Cube, their risk of infection from taking off PPE is essentially eliminated, says Dr. James Lawler of the University of Nebraska Medical Center, a leader in infectious disease research. He says hospitals will realize huge savings in the cost of disposing of used PPE and in personnel costs.
You are in your street clothes or in your scrubs while you're caring for patients, and you can move between different patients in these cubes very quickly. That efficiency creates significant staffing advantages. And so essentially, you can care for many more patients with fewer staff.
We do believe that this is a paradigm shift and offers a new tool in the toolkit for providing safe isolation care.
That's Dr. Yana Broadhurst, also a doctor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which cared for Americans repatriated from Wuhan and ill passengers from the cruise ship Diamond Princess. Dr. Broadhurst's perspective on patient experience in isolation units was influenced by her time caring for Ebola patients during the 2014 to 2015 outbreak in Africa. She has some personal experience as a patient as well.
I was very sick and had to be brought to and cared for in an isolation unit until I was ruled out for Ebola. It's a very frightening time, and you're really cut off from any interactions with your loved ones and from human interactions with your healthcare workers.
Dr. Broadhurst notes that the Care Cube's hug wall provides patients' loved ones the possibility of actually touching the patient. 10 Care Cube units have been evaluated at hospitals in New York and California, though not with real patients. The World Health Organization has expressed interest in manufacturing the Care Cube abroad. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
The state of Michigan has reached a $600 million settlement with victims of the Flint water crisis, 6 years after tens of thousands of people were exposed to lead in the city's water supply. Most of the money will go to children. Some 8,000 kids are believed to have had some level of lead poisoning in the city. The state is also proposing an additional $9 million settlement that will go toward a special education fund in Flint. It's a response to the class action lawsuit brought by the ACLU, demanding Flint schools test and accommodate the increased demand in special education programs. We're joined now by attorney Kristen Totten with the ACLU. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So big news yesterday, so much attention has been on the $600 million claim settlement, but that additional $9 million for schools is not insignificant. It's something that you've been fighting for. What's your reaction to these actions?
We have been working on this case for 5 years, and we are very excited because we knew that this would be the second phase of our case. The first part was the child find component, where we identify what the children's needs are. And we were able to settle that by getting a neurodevelopmental center established in Flint. The state gave us $4 million to get that operational. Now the rest of the case continues, which is once we are identifying what the children need, we have to make sure that they get the services and the interventions needed to address what needs they have.
Let's talk a little bit about those needs. We know that in Flint, 28% of the students are in special education. Can you break down for us what this fund is earmarked to do?
Yeah, so the details of the fund are still in process, and October 15th is when we have the due date to report those out. But what we're looking at is making sure that districts are putting evidence, validated resources in play to address the systemic needs of children that we're seeing. From the NCE, the Neurodevelopmental Center, we're seeing a lot of children come through there with a diagnosis of autism that was never captured by the school district. Diagnoses such as dyslexia, you know, for those kinds of disabilities, what are the targeted interventions that a district would need in order to address that? Because we see 28% is a very high rate of special education identification. The state average is 12%. So as we see the needs increase, we want to make sure that districts are encouraged to identify and meet those needs because children shouldn't have to figure that out, and they're incapable of doing that on their own, and they'll internalize the distress for not meeting the expectations of the adults, and they'll end up either shutting down and entering into the mental health system or acting out and entering into the criminal justice system. And we don't want that for any of the children of Flint who've been inflicted with this neurotoxin.
Kristen, I can imagine, though, this is kind of bittersweet because all the things that you're laying out and what you're fundamentally contending is that these children have been forever changed and altered by this exposure to lead.
Yes, that's been the difficulty of hearing the stories and bearing witness to what the families have experienced. And what we've been trying to do in this case and have been able to through the two settlements we've been able to achieve is to say, we hear you, we see you, and you're not alone. We want to make sure that we follow this through and get you the support that you need so that you're not gaslighted and thinking that it's all in your head. No, lead is an invisible disability that was inflicted upon your children. It's manifesting in these various challenges that your child now has. How can we walk with you through this rather than letting narratives that are racially infused, such as bad families or bad kids, or you're not reading to your child enough. Those are just lies that need to be dismissed. And we need to get to the truth as to how the children are really struggling and get the families the help that they need. There's such relief when a mama comes and tells me her story and I see it, I understand it, but I also want to be able to do something about it. And I really do believe that this settlement helps equip us to get us there.
How is this, if at all, complicated by the pandemic and the fact that so many students are remote learning and have moved to other places, other states, Detroit, and those types of things?
Yeah, so with the pandemic, it puts a whole other layer of crisis on top of the water crisis, the racism crisis, and the COVID crisis. So we are using it as a pause to really assess what the needs are by looking more closely at how the IEPs are identifying children. We're kind of utilizing this time of school closure and virtual platforms to get to a deeper need within those systems.
So what's next for Flint schools and the parents you represent? What are the next steps in getting this fund approved?
So the next steps are it has to be court approved. So we'll be going before the judge to get that approval. We have had all of the defendants in our case sign on, so we are already at work. But the beauty of this settlement is it extends beyond just Flint Community Schools. You know, the money's going to follow the children. So all the children that were inflicted, if they have gone to a charter school, if they have gone to another adjacent school district, those districts are going to be able to ask for resources to service the needs of the children of Flint. And the first step is we want to get a deeper dive assessment as to what the needs are within the educational system.
That's ACLU education attorney Kristen Totten. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
The Republican National Convention begins, and like the Democrats, it will be a virtual gathering. President Trump is poised to be renominated to run for a second term against former Vice President Joe Biden. We'll have full coverage of the RNC and the latest on COVID-19. That's next time on Here and Now.